thought I would share with you something interesting, which flows out of what we've been talking about and is very much in the headlines. So this is a recently published sefer with a recently published letter, a sefer called Shulchan Evan on Evan Ezer. So it has many thoughts on Evan Ezer. In the back it has a number of published tshuvas, some from Gedolim of previous generations, some from our contemporary Mechabrim. So one that really flows out of what we were talking about and is very current has to do with essentially the Prodfather trial that was recently taking place in New Jersey. And the question...
What is it, Prod?
The newspaper is called the Prodfather because they supposedly used cattle prods to... you're familiar with the basics of the case, right? The question was, there were Rabbanim who were on trial for being involved with kidnapping people and beating them up quite intensely in order to extract to get for them. So we had alluded to that last week, talking about Rav Shechter's observation, which we'll discuss here as well, about to what extent Dina de Malchusa Dina impacts on the situation. But there were a number of other objections, which all happen to be addressed in this letter I see here, which all make it interesting. But even though the title is one specific detail. So the title, this is a letter that was written by Rav Shlomo Miller. If you're familiar, Rav Shlomo Miller is a very prominent Rosh Kollel from Toronto. And there is an essay here entitled Kfiya Beget Kishadonu Sholo Bifnei Habal, which was one of the major elements of this case that was tried in New Jersey recently. The issue being that, in addition to the other problems, the question of violation of civil law in terms of the kidnapping and the beating, etc., but a major part of the issue is that the husbands in question were not present when the decisions were made. That basically, again, if you read the papers, so what happened was you would contact this Beis Din, you'd contact this rabbi, a group of rabbis, and let's say it would be a woman coming to them and saying that my husband's not giving a get, I think you got to do something. So they would determine that this husband deserves to be forced. So as we've seen over the past few days, that it's not a simple decision when the husband deserves to be forced. So to adjudicate such a matter, if he's not present to present his case, is a big question. How exactly could that happen? So this was a problem so much so that the FBI was able to prosecute this case using a husband that didn't exist for the sting operation, that they came to these rabbis and they said that the woman who was working for the FBI claimed that her husband was such and such. I guess I'm getting the details right. I don't know all the details, but I think this is generally the point. And it was all a fictional story, but they agreed to take on the beating of this fictional character based on their description. So that obviously sheds a lot of question, sheds a lot of doubt on the whole situation, being that the husband didn't exist in the first place. But it prompts the question, so it highlights the fact that there was nobody here to respond to the accusations. So to what extent should that matter? Parenthetically, it happens to be that even though it's not in the title here, so you see that he addresses this here also. See, it's not clear from the title in the sefer here that he's addressing this famous newspaper case, but then you see paragraphs that he adds at the end, it's very clear that it is either that case or cases very similar to it because of extra points he makes at the end. Part of what bothered many people in that situation, so for example, so many people asked, well, you know, don't these guys deserve to be beat up? Don't they deserve whatever is going to happen to them being they were engaged in such cruelty? So first of all, they have to exist to establish that they deserve such type of treatment. But you know, the fact that they were able to make a case in terms of people who didn't even exist was part of what undermine the credibility of such a system, but also, as was widely reported, so there was a huge fee for carrying this out. So it gave the impression, whether it's a fair impression or not, that this psak is basically being bought. And is it possible at all that a psak under those circumstances could be a legitimate psak? So he addresses this here also, Rav Miller, again making it clear that he's either talking about this case or a case very similar to it. So just without reading it all inside, but just to share with you some of the fascinating points which flow out of what we spoke about. So here it happens to be so that this the case he talks about here, the woman claims that he's got some terrible smell associated with him, which is one of the things that was mentioned in the Mishnah. And here he points out that there was no established proof that that's the case. So what's a greater element to the case being asked here was the element of Moes Alai. And the question of whether Moes Alai can factor in is already itself a machlokas, as we discussed yesterday. And that even though, as he quotes here, that Pasku Haramah, Seminayin Zayin, Chalk Mechokek, Bishmul, Doloi Kaifinan, even though it seems to be that the mainstream psak, especially in Ashkenazic circles, is that we are not Kofa on Moes Alai. I emphasize my Ashkenazic circles, because, as we have discussed, so the Rambam was of the opinion, the Rambam was the one who said that we can be kofa for Moes Alai. So the question is there any room for one to feel like he passing is like the Rambam? So, for example, Bavadja, who also isn't really willing to go all the way there by himself, but probably gives more weight to this view than other poskim do, presumably as a function of a Sephardi perspective. And one of the things he addresses in his Chuvas is if, let's say, you're dealing with a Taimani couple that, or a Taimani context, where the idea is that the Taimani community is believed to follow the Rambam for everything, so can they, in such a context, invoke the Rambam's psak? So Bavadja has a Chuv about this. Rav Shechter told me that Rav Kapach was very involved in these issues, so it was said about him that he actually believed the Rambam's position is correct, that you can be kofa Moes Alai, but because so many poskim didn't accept that, so he never wanted to rely on that by itself, so he always looked for something else, and he always found something else. There was always be something else. So I mentioned in the time that Rav Kapach was himself a Taimani, so presumably he has more license to follow the Rambam. But there's a lot to question about that as well. You know, if the couple is not Taimani, if the couple is Taimani, is that still enough? I was recently talking to another Taimani, Tamil Chacham, who emphasized it's not really true. They follow the Rambam for everything. There's a little bit more of a discussion. And there are those who say also that even among those communities that follow the Rambam, some of the Achronim say that because the issue was so chomer, we're still not necessarily ready to jump on the bandwagon with that. Hi.
Can Rebbe explain again what's the problem with the guy might not exist?
Well, because
they thought the guy was existing.
Right, but it just highlights the fact that they're not getting the full story here. Mm-hmm. Because the proof that her claims about his behavior were not true is very blatant because he doesn't exist. So clearly he's not doing any of the things that she is accusing him of doing or having any of the qualities that she is accusing him of having. So it just highlights the fact that it could be that there might be accusations against the person who does exist, but may not be true. This is the epitome of not truth because he's the whole person isn't even Ba'olam, but it seems like it's a Kal V'chomer that it could be the person does exist and the claims aren't true. Now, you might argue on that Kal V'chomer, and it might be a legitimate argument because one might say that, no, that's not necessarily such a compelling point, because if there was actually a husband who was in real life and these things weren't true, so then he would be able...
Have you ever heard of them beating up the wrong guy?
They probably have.
Oh, they have.
Yeah, I probably have. But in this case, it's not...
They got paid that with the FBI. That's their jobs.
Right, so that's it. I've seen some discussion about that, and some make that point, because I think the President of America was also willing to issue a seder, at least in one case was a discussion. I don't know all the facts about it. But the point was made by some that, no, that doesn't really show you anything. It shows you that the world's best, hopefully, you know, the world's best spy agency, not spy, you know, the world's best law enforcement agency, was able to outsmart them, or was able to put on a picture that was compelling enough, that doesn't necessarily cast any doubt on the system. Which, you know, hopefully that's true. That in the case of, let's say, a Seiruv, so a Seiruv basically just says the person is refusing to cooperate. So, okay, so there isn't so much danger in saying that he's refusing to cooperate if it turns out he doesn't really exist in the first place. But when a person does exist, so then it becomes a little more complicated, and he could tell you that he doesn't exist. So how much you want to derive from that is questionable, but it seems to, on the surface, illustrate the problem of just taking one side of the story. So he notes here that, okay, so yes, we probably don't paskin Moisulai is good enough. But, okay, there are those who collected all the opinions that do rely on that, and there are times we've been willing to rely on it, or maybe we rely on it b'dieved, that if the woman remarried based on this, we're not going to make her divorce the second husband, which, by the way, was the position of the Rush. The Rush and the Tshuva, the Rush got angry at the Rambam for allowing divorce, allowing kfiya based on Moisulai, and he takes very strong issue with it, but even the Rush, who's one of the most vehement opponents of the position, but he also says, but I'm talking about from here on in, anyone who relied on it in the past, okay, so yeshal malismach, you know, that the opinion is there, he thinks it's totally wrong, but the opinion is there, so if anyone relied on it in the past, he's not going to cast any aspersions on it. So, let's assume that there's what to talk about, even though he's not so excited about it. So, what would you say about this? This goes then to the question that we were discussing, that, strictly speaking, as he quotes here from the Shach and the Nesivos HaMishpat, Mechosha Mishpat, that in general you can't have a din against somebody who's not there. You can't have a din Torah against somebody who can't express his positions. But does Moisulai factor in differently? So what would you think about that question? What's he getting at? Why should Moisulai factor in differently? Because, yes, Marty?
Sometimes the whole point of that, we want to be, the judge wants to be able to judge how accurate one side is portraying the other one. But if Moisulai is inherently subjective, then we could theoretically act on that, so that wouldn't make as much difference.
So that's basically the premise of the question. That should we say that if we do want to define Moisulai as essentially whatever she claims disturbs her qualifies, which we saw in the past day or two is a little bit of a debate, so maybe there's nothing to talk about. Maybe there are certain situations where we can get enough information from one side without the other side having to establish the position. So if you're going to say that that's the case, so should that be enough? And should we say that since she can just say, I'm disgusted by him, so nothing he's going to say is really going to make a difference about that, so that should be grounds to be done not in his presence. So he is not willing to go that far. As he points out, and this is also a complex issue, that we have to figure out further. It's going to affect a lot of questions, and I was actually just discussing a shaila about this morning. It gets very complicated. That sometimes you have a situation where the husband is ready to acknowledge that he's going to divorce his wife, but there are certain other unresolved issues that, in terms of the resolution of the divorce, that are tied in with the get. So that's also a part of the same din Torah. Right? Basically, when the husband and wife come to the din Torah, so all the issues are resolved in terms of the custody, in terms of the property, in terms of the giving of the get. So one has to figure out to what extent, and again, like this was Islamish involved in this today, what are the relationship between the different issues? So maybe the husband will say, okay, she hates me and she wants me to divorce her, okay, but the terms of the divorce we still have to clarify. So can there be a psak without him present in order to establish that? So that's one concern, that he's not so sure that that can work. Another issue that he's worried about is that if we're going to say that the kfiya is premised on the mitzvah, so then to what extent is the mitzvah premised on certain other elements? Where does the mitzvah come from? Right? So what is the mitzvah that's involved in giving of a get. So let's assume, even though one could suggest a couple possibilities, but the one that's actually in the Gemara is the mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim. So there you have a couple of questions. First of all, what if the issue is a machlokas? And so here he quotes a tshuva l'chassam sofer, that if something is a matter of debate, then maybe that casts another problem into the mix. Because even if the system of halacha could give you basis to rely on the opinion that says that kfiya is appropriate, but if the husband has reason to think that's not true, so then maybe that will undermine the whole system. Right? If the husband might say that he understands the other way, that he understands like the Rishonim that he's not obligated, so then, do we still have the same ability to say that the mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim is going to be the active factor? Right, we discussed yesterday a question which seems much more extreme, but maybe is relevant, that let's say the husband is a mishumad, right? If the husband doesn't subscribe to Judaism at all, so the question of whether the Rambam's Pintel Yid theory can apply to him was a topic of debate. But here's a different side of that question. Let's say he's a very religious Jew. But if he has reason to believe, and it's reason with foundation, to believe that the halacha is on his side, so then maybe we can't say that his Pintel Yid wants to follow this mitzvah.
That's Kimli?
So Kimli is a related concept, but the point here is that it's going to operate differently. So basically, just explaining what we're talking about. Did we talk about Kimli at the beginning of the year? I think it came up, right? Basically, with Kimli, so here it's a different kind of Kimli, because it's an interesting question how Kimli applies. Basically, what Kimli means is that if you have a monetary dispute between two people, so normally we should decide the dispute as a point of halacha. We should decide which svara is more compelling or which position in Rishonim has more support. And we should paskin like we paskin any other issue in halacha. Like we'll paskin in Hilchos Shabbos. We'll decide, okay, it's machlokas Rishonim, but one side has more support in terms of other Rishonim or has more proof to it, so we'll paskin like that side. So that should be true also in a monetary dispute. The problem is that if there is enough of a minority position, you have to figure out in the Klali HaPsak what's considered to be enough of a minority position. So then, there is room for one side to say, Kimli, that I subscribe personally to that opinion. And that means the side that is the muhsak, the side that has the money, can say he always has an inherent advantage because of the principle of hamotze mechaver olav haraya. So there's always an inherent advantage to the muhsak, the person who has the money in his property. So sometimes you have this principle, and the klolim are very complicated, but sometimes you have this principle that a minority view can be invoked by the muhsak to say, okay, you think that view is wrong, but I hold like this view, and therefore I'm allowed to hold on to my money. Right.
Is a get considered monetary?
So not necessarily, although, as we'll see in the next few days, it can be intertwined with all kinds of monetary issues. And that becomes very complicated. Like, for example, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Yeah, but let's say, so for example, the prenup, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but just... for example, if the prenup is contingent on his obligation to support her, so what if that obligation is in doubt? All right, so then does it still exist? We'll have to see. You know, it gets a little more complicated. So maybe so, but it's part of a discussion. So here, we don't even have to come on to that. So that's Morty's question, that are we invoking Kimli here? So maybe yes, but here what the Chassam Sofer's point is that how can we say necessarily is a mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim that here refers to a machlokas, the Rashi and Mordechai, about a specific situation. So the phrase that he uses here is man leimalon shemitzvah l'shmoa divrei harash delma mitzvah l'shmoa divrei hamordechai. Right? How is he going to say that he has an obligation? He should feel he should do the mitzvah to follow the Rashi. Maybe he has a mitzvah to follow the Mordechai. So that's also an objection that he has here. So he notes that there are many poskim who don't follow this Chassam Sofer, right? And especially because, I think I mentioned this a few minutes ago, right, that the Rush himself And when he is such a vehement opponent of following the Rambam Moasalai, also acknowledges that b'di'evet it still works. So there are many poskim who will accept that b'di'evet. So why is that? So here he suggests as follows. So why is it that there are poskim who are willing to be okay with this after the fact, even if it's a machlokas rishonim? It says, nearly, so here this is a little bit of a bridge between this year's Masechta and next year's Masechta. So between this whole sugi is really a bridge between the two, right, between Ksubis and Sanhedrin. So one of the major issues in the beginning of Sanhedrin, big, big sugi, very exciting to look forward to, is the question of when is a psak reversible? Right, so what kind of mistakes are considered to be real mistakes that can be undone? So here he notes that he thinks that the position to be makel here says nearly taimam de kaimalan b'choshem mishpat simin chavhei de ta b'shikul hadas. That there's different kinds of mistakes. Right? There's a mistake davar hamishna that you could just get the text wrong, or there's a mistake in assessing something, a mistake b'shikul hadas. So there, if we pass in the Shulchan Aruch that a mistake in such a case kam dina, it stays as it is, not reversible. So then you could say, "Bezdin kaful utain get al tainus moes alai yishlomer the sugi de alma kaimel and ain kai for al tainus moes alai mikol makim yishlomer the eved dino din the tabashik ladas kam dina v'mkani yishol mitzvah torah zvadai l'shmo lebezdin misad hilchus of the kam dina." That maybe the opposing position is that even if his bezdin was basically wrong in adding up the parts here, in terms of relying on moes alai, but maybe b'di'evit, it's still a psak that's going to be binding anyway, even if they are arguably wrong. So if they have a psak, so then, okay, so then that creates a mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim. So then he adds here, b'din kam dina b'tav b'shikol adas, parch z'dav kim pasku adin machnas tav b'shikol adas. That's assuming that the mistake was based on their assessment. Avam tov b'davar mishnah, if the mistake was in something explicit, even though they know there's another way to support their position, and had they relied on that opinion, that would be a shikul hadas mistake. It's all complicated analysis that depends on what kind of logic they're using. That if they're not basing it on them in this other position, but they're basing it on essentially what boils down to a mistake, so then that is reversible. So he says, basically, in this situation, the Bezdin knows that the Ramah is passing against this. Even though they could bring in this minority view together with other reasons, right? But there is objective mistakes here because they didn't listen at all to the Tainus Habal because he wasn't present. He's not even addressing the question whether he existed or not. Listen, the case where the Baal did exist, right? Well, the case where he didn't exist, that's where they got arrested. But before that, they were dealing with Baalim who did exist. The only one who ever came with someone who didn't exist was the FBI. But before that, they were dealing with people who did exist. So, Gam Tanis Reicha Perech Adomine Emes Klal, whatever she claims seems to not be true, she says, these are objective mistakes. This doesn't qualify as Shikol Hadas kind of mistakes. So, if that's true, Iker Tami Apsak, in the Tabad of Mishnah, Mahani Masha Asus Niflahet, the Tabad of Tabad Shikol Hadas, Cave in the Mitam Zeluchud, Lohayum Marim Kain. Right, so what's he basically saying? He's saying that in this case he's talking about, so there was a number of factors, and also they threw in as a sniff the position of Moshe Alai. They weren't relying on that totally, because the Ramah doesn't accept it, but together with other things, like you sometimes find the post can bring it in together with other things. So it says, okay, so that assessment, you could say that's a Shikol Hadas error. But together with the other things, which are essentially explicit errors because he wasn't there to defend himself, and that he claims is explicit error, and that you don't have, and some of the points that she was claiming apparently in this case were demonstrably untrue, so then you have a serious problem. So then, as he notes, that we also have a bigger problem here then, because since we're dealing with Isui beget, since we're dealing with a situation where you are compelling a get, so if we're going to say that that is contingent on the mitzvah circumstance, so then that requires a real honest-to-goodness psak. And if we don't have a psak, if the psak is invalid based on the halachos of psak, based on Hilchos Sanhedrin, again, here's our bridge, so then that's a problem in terms of justifying the kfiyah in the first place. And since when it comes to kfiyah, so the Shulchan Aruch says that if the kfiyah is done illegitimately, it's a get ma'usa. So we're going to discuss, I guess at this point, probably tomorrow, what constitutes kfiyah and what doesn't. But there's no question that hitting the guy, according to everybody, is kfiyah. And since that's what we're talking about, and the kfiyah is not really flowing from any real psak, so then we have a serious issue. So that's a point he makes. And then he goes on to say that someone had the opinion here that you can have a din of kfiyah on a person who's not there when it's known for sure that he's chayiv. So he doesn't accept that because he feels you need to hear his claims in order to establish that. Let's skip to the end because we have to end in a few minutes. Okay, so for various reasons he doesn't accept that. And then the last two paragraphs we'll just read together address more specifically the exact case that was dealt with in the trial in the news. So just to look at them together, it says, Milvad kol hanal. Right, this next point is essentially Rav Schachter's point. Milvad kol hanal, halo kifi chukei hamedina, according to the laws of the country, also lahakos b'shutim, you're not allowed to beat people up, who oven plili, it's a criminal offense, b'fratim nasulei de rabbanim, says specifically if it's done by rabbanim, I don't know why specifically, but I mean, as far as civil law, I don't know if it makes it any more illegal, but okay.
So you're famous.
Sorry?
Isn't that like if you're famous or whatever, or you're a higher position in society?
It's more illegal. Okay, could be. So Kfar Kosser Rekivya Eger, that Rekivya Eger writes that Mutal Kol Rav Moro Yosher Lahazir Asama Shor Yosher Bekirbo Ki Chayin Dvar Hamelach Yishmor Kurosav Al Yamaru Al Yamru, that one is obligated to follow the laws of the country and the king, and he shouldn't deviate and rebel against his dictates. Uvasher gamanochi esait v'chulei lachas kam v'kamash v'asmi yin avakayim. So I guess, you know, he's saying from a halachic point of view that all the more so the Rav himself has to be careful to follow the law. So therefore he thinks that that itself creates a very serious problem. And then in this last paragraph, so he makes another point, the footnote after he already signs his name. So, but this again was the point that I think bothered people the most about the situation, no matter where they really felt, what they really held about the whole get issue in general, that this detail, I think, bothered everybody on both sides of the fence. So it says, Befrat kefish nisbara charkach, Rabbani Habezdin poskim in Sara Isha, Shabbat Heter, Mshrichim Mashalim, $20,000, right, that since it came out that that's what she had to pay, the woman, so then there is no greater bribery than that. That she's obligated essentially to pay this specifically when that is the psak, that there is kfiyah. $30,000. Bad har b'ryonim hamakim, that they have to then pay another $30,000 for the hooligans, however you want to translate Brionim, essentially what it means, the Hasofer, the Ha'idim, and to then also pay costs. This also includes the witnesses and the Sofer. Sim Kain, Bezdin, Shadonu, Al Pishochad, Vadai, Dinan, Bato. So a Bezdin that is going to rule based on Shochad, for sure the Din is Bato. So again, that was something that intuitively everyone was upset about because it struck people as wrong for a lot of reasons. Some people said, okay, well, that's what the gangsters charge, so that's what they got to pass on. But there, first of all, it seems like you are And this is an issue which we'll address over the next few days, that it seems like you're essentially extorting the woman. Right? The woman is basically taking advantage of someone in a desperate situation and saying, okay, I can solve your problem for a six-figure sum or a five-figure sum, whichever way it is. So then, okay, so either the husband can extort her or a third party can extort her. But either way, she's being extorted by somebody. So it doesn't make this person who's, so to speak, helping very sympathetic if he's only going to do so under terms that are similar to what you'd have to pay off the husband. And it also casts a shadow over the whole thing, that just how legitimate is this psak. So we see that that's important for two reasons. One, it's important because it has to actually correspond to reality, that there really is a chiyuv kfiyah here, and who knows if that's really true. And secondly, even if it really is true, so the kfiyah has to flow from some direct mitzvah. If we want to follow the Rambam and other Rishonim who say that's what's going on, then it's the mitzvah l'shmo adivrei chachamim that justifies the kfiyah. So if there is no clear sense that this really represents the divrei chachamim because it was essentially bought, so that it's a very major question whether or not you can say that that's a function of such a mitzvah. So we'll pick up tomorrow again about what actually constitutes kfiyah and what doesn't. Just want to mention also a detail I think I left out yesterday when I said that there basically are, let's say, three views about Moyes Alai. The Rambam who says you can be kofa, and those who say you can't, which were in two views, those who say objectively you can't, and it just doesn't meet the standard, and those who say that maybe you could theoretically, but we can't establish that it's really there, so you can't for that reason. There is a fourth view also, that many of the Rishonim quote a Takanas HaGaonim, that there were some of the later Rabbanim who said that we have to make a policy to allow kfiyah for Moyes Alai, because if we're going to leave this woman stuck, then who knows what's going to happen religiously, spiritually. Oh, it's going to be all kinds of very major problems. So therefore, they made a takana that the kofa for Moyes Alai. Whether or not that was accepted was a matter of major debate. A lot of Rishonim said that it never took place, it doesn't really make it, it's not the established policy. But it's also something that is discussed when weighing up the various factors. And part of analyzing that issue was also whether maybe kfiyah is really based on some type of afkeinu, some type of the Beis Din deciding that there is essentially no more marriage here. And then the question is, who has the authority to do that? Is that only Chazal, or is that even later authorities? And then maybe that's what was going on, that the Gaonim were basically saying that, okay, we're also applying Afkinu here under these circumstances, and some Rishonim felt that that was acceptable, and some Rishonim felt it wasn't acceptable, and that was also a part of the debate. But it doesn't seem to be essentially the policy, although, as we'll see perhaps tomorrow, that it does still show up in some ways in terms of practical halacha today. All right, I apologize for the shift in schedule. That one tomorrow night will be a normal time.
So you leave out American law, and I guess the exorbitant bribe fees, then my dad, those scenarios, like the torture was fine.
Well, not fine yet. We'll see. There's still some other parts missing. What's your name?
Right here.